He is the new voice of talk radio, Alexander Danilov.
Good evening, all. Welcome back to Solutionsology Radio. I appreciate you tuning in. The great support we got the other night. My guest the other night was John Steele Gordon, very noted historian, one of the leading historians out there. He was on to talk about his book, Washington's Monument and the Obelisk. Something that, unfortunately, he's not talked too much about is the history of the statues and monuments that we have in our country and what they stand for, the symbolism, where it came from, all that kind of stuff. So on the heels of that, I'm very excited to have my guest on tonight, who's been in the market for north of 25 years. He's written extensively on the markets. He's also the founder of slopeofhope.com. He's the author, which we're now celebrating as of yesterday, a two-year anniversary of the release, is Panic, Prosperity, and Progress, Five Centuries of History in the Markets. My guest tonight is Timothy Knight. So happy and so honored to have you on tonight, Tim.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for including me.
Absolutely. So I came across your book. I think it was through the Amazon suggested readings or stuff like that. And I started looking. I'm like, this is pretty awesome. Then I checked out Slope of Hope. I'm like, how did I not know this guy? And all the years I've been doing my show and all the amazing guests I've had on, from financial and otherwise, what you did here, and I've actually written about the markets and technical analysis and things like that through your other books, which you'll mention later. But this book, Panic, Prosperity, and Progress, takes a different level. It's actually the history of the markets in a way that so many people haven't heard of, or if they have, it's been scattered. This is a one place. It's holistic. It's an all-in-one reading resource for markets and things like that. So please kindly introduce the book to us, and once again, congrats on the 2 years that it's been out.
Oh, sure. Well, I've been writing a long time. I just go back to some ancient history here. I got mixed up with computers when they first came out, literally like in like 79, 80. And I wrote, basically paid my way through college, writing computer books. And the thing is that my interest sort of multiplied from there, beyond just computers and writing, but later to stock trading. And the thing is, and why I'm not sure, but I've got a very strong interest in history. And after all those books that I'd written, you know, it's funny because every time I finished writing a book, I figured, well, that's it. There's no more books in me. And I'd done literally like two dozen different books. And I had thought to myself, what would it be like to look at history through the lens of stock charts? Because I thought to myself, you know, what did the stock market do when Kennedy was shot? And what did the stock market do when the hostages were freed from Iran? This kind of thing. And I was wondering to myself because I look at the stock market all the time, and sometimes charts seem to be almost prescient about what's going to happen before it actually even happens. Mm-hmm. And so I started to dig into that, and what surprised me was that all the places you think would be really interesting movements and changes, really nothing much happened. Mm-hmm. And it was really that as a basis that I started dialing back literally hundreds of years to see over the course of time, what are the big events that have taken place, not just through history, but financial history, and how are those reflected in price charts? So that was kind of the genesis of the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tim, obviously you knew a lot of the stuff that was in here, a lot of stuff you stumbled upon, which is a lot of fascinating stuff. Of course, you knew about the tulip craze beforehand. I'd like for you to touch on that, but I'd like for you to talk about the Mississippi scheme and the importance of John Law and what his message had. We talk about Adam Smith a lot and the invisible hand that guides the market and all that kind of stuff. People have heard that before, but nobody's really heard about John Law. A lot of people have heard about Keynesianism, but they don't really know Keynesian economics, but they don't really know too much about it, even though it's been growing in popularity, even amongst economists outside on the, I guess, the right side, the Republican side of the aisle. So let's talk about that. Let's touch on the tulip craze and how that same mentality, that market craze, that exuberance, irrational exuberance, so to speak, still takes hold because it's psychology is at the helm of it always. And then let's move on to John Law and when people start trying to make sense of all this.
Right. Well, I mean, most of your listeners have probably either read or heard about Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. This is the, famed book written quite a long time ago, or back in the 19th century, about big crazes that have taken place, especially with a financial flavor to them over the course of time. And the one that almost everybody knows, even if their knowledge doesn't extend much farther than the term tulip mania, is tulip mania. And, in spite of the fact 99% of people listening have heard about this, just to take a sentence or two about it, this became an obsession in Holland because, tulips are relatively unknown, and to the kind of this new growing middle class and upper middle class, they found this pretty flower was a nice way to, it's a status symbol, it's a nice way to distinguish themselves. And as such, it became a viable commodity unto itself. And it started off relatively slowly, but as with any, take Bitcoin or gold back in 1979 or any other fabled craze, it started to take off exponentially. And it's what's interesting to me about researching the book is they, way back in, this was some over 400 years ago, this was a fairly sophisticated futures and futures options market. And it all took place in, the Netherlands. There are some stories that are sort of apocryphal that you'd read about in McKay's book, like, the man who had this incredibly valuable tulip bulb and a friend came over and he thought it was an onion and he ate it, things like that. Cut those apart in the book, explain how those really didn't take place. But what certainly did take place is that there was a manic obsession and a financial explosion in tulips. And it's not particularly interesting in as much as this was a huge market. I mean, unlike, say, our own financial crisis of 2008, it affected a very tiny number of people. But what's interesting as far as studying this is it's a template for what happens when a given novelty captures the public imagination, and what happens when, frankly, more and more ignorant people just sort of pile in and try to get that last little kind of greater fool theory in action. And of course, as always does, it'll terminate with the last guy holding the bag, and it just comes crashing down even faster than it ascended. So that's my whirlwind tour of tulip mania.
Yep, and let's move on to when it's people just trying to start making sense of it and create theories around things like this, the psychology of it, and best practices both from a government standpoint and things like that through John Law and Keynesian economics.
Well, yeah, so it wasn't that many hundreds of years ago where the notion of paper money really didn't exist. I mean, if we think about it, it wasn't that many decades ago where the notion of credit cards didn't really exist. And back in Law's time, I feel like I'm taking a final on history test because I don't have my book in front of me, but this is fact, in the early 1700s, if I recall properly. And at the time, France was mired in debt because of some costly wars. They had a fondness for going to war with other countries. And of course, at the time, all wealth and all exchangeable wealth was in the form of gold, principally. And the John Law had a penchant for ingratiating himself to royalty, and as most middle class folks do, he has a fondness for ascending the social ladder. And he managed through the Duke of Orleans to make the acquaintance of King Louis and explain to him this notion he had of creating what he called a land bank, allowing the state to essentially use the assets they had in terms of real estate as a basis for creating new money. In other words, imagine the government owning a tremendous amount of property and essentially creating tiny ownership in that property by way of deeds, and thus you can generate more funding for your own government to pay off debt and go fund other wars and things of this nature. And over the course of time, Law, through his financial engineering and financial innovation, became more and more powerful in the kingdom of France. until such time as it came to a point where he had his own, basically ran what we would think of kind of the central bank there, which had its own paper currency. And unlike today, the paper currency was sort of a quasi-stock. It represented sort of an ownership in the bank itself. And this really cure-all that Law had created for the government, it met with success after success after success. And as its reputation grew, the general public bid up the value of his enterprise in much the same way a lot of small internet startups did back in 1999. And as with Tulip Mania, it reached a frenzied peak and came crashing down. And by the time it was all done, John Law had to put on a woman's dress and sneak out of the country. He was so hated and hunted down. So this was, unlike Tulip Mania, this was kind of a nationwide phenomena, and it really affected the psyche of France so deeply, it would be many, many decades before they dared touch anything that wasn't gold, hard metal for their financial dealings.
Mm-hmm. And once again, speaking with Timothy Knight, the founder of Slope of Hope. Yeah, he's been trading in the markets. He's been learning and studying the markets for north of 25 years. And I'm not saying that to date you, Tim. I'm just pointing out, obviously, yeah, your experience and the intense passion that you have for the history of it, which is quite evident in the book we're speaking about now, which is Panic, Prosperity, and Progress. It's a thick book. You're not going to read in one sitting, most likely, especially if you're me. But over time, you chop through it, and you start finding so many great tidbits like what we've discussed already and what we're going to discuss now. So kind of the opposite of Keynesian economics and government intervention and things like that, which has grown so popular really since the late 20s and 30s with the rise of FDR and obviously John Maynard Keynes and all this kind of stuff. And it started taking root and started growing and progressivism, all that stuff. So, but before that, we had what you considered an economic constitution or more of a financially oriented constitution where it allowed for people to be industrious and all that kind of stuff and more of a free market system. And there were presidents here and there up to that point, obviously up to the point where we are now, that deviated. There were ones that stayed true to it. And one of the guys that you mentioned here, I think you know who I'm talking about here, is Grover Cleveland. And the story of, I'm going to actually read, this is from page 107 for those keeping score at home. Mm-hmm. The president's desire for a hands-off government was persistent in his political philosophy. Even when it came to the modest requisition of $10,000, which again at that time was different, the idea is still the same, in seed for Texas farmers who had just suffered a drought, Cleveland voted the bill, and part of his explanation was written, you know, so he wrote that, the reason why he wasn't a fan of this kind of these kinds of things. And so I'd like for you to talk more about that, because again, we've done a complete 180 from that point, and it just seems to keep changing, and more government control keeps intervening in the market. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, the example you just cited sort of shows at the other extreme, you know, a degree of financial prudence, even ethics, some might say, about personal responsibility and government aid / intervention, which would be completely alien to us today. Because, I mean, that spans from a time where basically it's like, you know, kind of every man for himself. And, you know, the government's role is very, very limited to, you know, national defense and enforcement of contracts and that kind of thing. And not, you know, if you screw up, we're going to rush in and save the day for you. And what's fascinating to me about not only writing the book, but watching the market day to day, is that if you, with the right perspective, we live through history and can watch history unfold before our eyes through these markets. Because in sharp contrast to the example you just cited, now the central banks of the, you know, like Deutsche Bank or any large organization which is teetering or having trouble has no hesitation about pleading for a bailout, or, you know, just keep that sugar rush running, Janet Yellen or whoever they might be. So the world has become completely inured to bailouts, infinite aid, And essentially, as they say, you know, profits are all private and losses are all socialized. And so it was really, for me, the process of researching and writing the book was really eye-opening, because it really showed you how, over the course of time, how radically things have changed. And my view is that what we're experiencing, especially since the financial crisis, is an exponential change in just how fast things are going and, frankly, how complicated the world has become. Because, like, I do this for a living. It's like all I do is study financial markets, watch the markets morning, noon, and night. And frankly, I barely have a grasp as to what's going on. So you can imagine that 99% of the people who don't do this stuff, it's a totally blank slate. They have no earthly idea what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and once again, I'm speaking with Timothy Knight, the founder of Slope of Hope, a stock market veteran. Great site, obviously, Slope of Hope. We'll talk about that now. You mentioned, you know, how hard it is to stay on top of everything, and then there's those that are just more technically savvy, which based on technical analysis, you don't really need to know what's going on, although I don't really believe that when they say I just look at the charts, because it's human nature to want to know what the heck just happened when you get stopped out. You tweet out earlier, two lousy stop outs, and you want to know why you got stopped out, what happened. You know, that happens all the time. So we try to make sense of what it is. We oversimplify. We want it to happen quickly. And again, you've been doing this for a long time. So let's go to your trading rules, which you posted. You posted on your site for all to see. And I printed this out. Mm-hmm. This is going to be something I use as a primer, Tim. And the thing that has troubled me so much, and I've helped a good amount of people make truckloads of money, and I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars over time, and it's a short period of time. But for myself, when I got involved, I had problems with my emotions. I had problems with a whole bunch of things. Wasn't the case when I first started, which is counterintuitive, and that's exactly how the market is. It messes with you that way, because what you think should happen and what we think is good in the real world, you play nice, all that, things will happen for you. That's not the case in the markets, and emotional awareness of one of those things that we just don't really have a grasp on. So let's talk about that, and let's talk about the rest of your trading rules, because even you wish that you stay true to it more often, and you've been burned by deviating.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny what you mentioned about the normal way of doing things doesn't apply. I think it was a different book I wrote. I wrote a book about profit charts, which is a product my company Profit created. And I laid out an analogy whereby, just to preface this, in the regular world, if you do things, like if you flip burgers for X number of hours, or if you manage the accounting books for X number of days, what have you, you put in effort and you get a reward. You get a paycheck, you get a bonus, you get paid, you know, time, intelligence, effort, what have you, and always yield some kind of payback. And the thing that's tough to get used to in the world of trading is that not only is that not guaranteed, but you may work really, really, really hard for a really, really, really long time and not only not get paid, but lose money. And that it's very seductive to think that, you know, you can just pluck money out of the market. But the first rule to really realize is that no one is going to pay you anything, irrespective of the blood, sweat, and tears and time you've put into it. And as far as the rules go, I mean, I don't think there's a soul out there, from the greatest hedge fund manager on down, who is immune to all the emotions, which basically are constructed beautifully to combat good trading. And, you know, you read the same things I do. I mean, some of the greatest hedge fund managers out there who run billions and billions of dollars, down this year, you know, here we are in middle February, they're down 10 or 15% already, and it hasn't even been that dramatic of a market. You can get swept up in these things. So the reason I put the list together, and for those of you who haven't seen it, it's a very small, very simple list, because there's tons of lists out there, and I've seen, lists that are like 50 or 100 different trading rules, and that's just useless. It's too bewildering. Mm-hmm. I try to keep it very, very simple. Mm-hmm. And, one of the key things that I follow is just a religious use of stop-loss prices. Some people can't stand stop. Some people think it's foolhardy to do so, and the tweet you mentioned earlier is, from time to time, it'll burn you. But as a rule, it's a way for me to carve out the emotional element. And in the calm evening hours when I'm looking at charts, I can say, this is the number, which if crossed means I am wrong. And bang, it's in there permanently as a stop loss price until such time as I adjust it later in another pleasant evening. And what I'm saying there is that by going through this process, I take myself largely out of the picture, you know, because sometimes people say, well, I'll use mental stops, which is kind of a backhanded way of saying that, well, I'll just kind of make it up as I go along, you know, and that to me
dangerous,
is
very dangerous.
It allows you to seduce yourself into hanging on, or it'll come back, or da-da-da-da-da. You can rationalize until you just can't stand the pain anymore, then you get out. That's probably the very worst price of the day. So, those rules, I have, to me, it's almost like the Constitution of the United States. I rarely, rarely change them. I put a lot of thought into them. And I do try to, some mornings, it's the first thing I do before I even flip on the computer, to kind of reread them, even though I know them, you know, pretty well. So.
Yeah, so, it's an amazing, again, it's very alluring. I talk to people about it all the time. Some people are terrified. Some people want to get into it balls deep, for lack of better words, don't really want to know anything about it because it's so easy, Tim, to make a trade, to place a trade. And like you said, it's you do it until you can't take the pain anymore if you're on the wrong side of it. And you're always going to be on the wrong side when you're feeling pain. You know, no matter how nervous you are, when you enter a trade, you buy 1,000 shares of whatever, let's say Facebook, and that's obviously an expensive move, but you buy 1,000 shares of that, and if it goes up immediately, all that fear, all that nervousness, all that angst that you had is gone quickly, and you start being, man, this is easy, I can get greedy. By the time you rationalize how good you are for however you get there, you're down 2-3 points on the move, and you're like, what the heck just happened? And you can't even leave, no matter how badly you want to go to the bathroom, you can't leave. So it's a constant self-battle. Go on.
Well, no, I was just going to say, we have, humans have certain commonalities in terms of our emotions, but we also have unique characteristics which we have to sort of adapt to our own trading style. Like in my instance, I greatly prefer spreading risk out amongst lots and lots and lots of little positions. So I'd rather not just take some bold stand and have, like, you know, some massive position of spiders and that's it. I'd much rather have literally like 100 different tiny positions, which chart to chart I sort of manage them myself. So it's kind of a bottom up way of investing, and it's a way of not only spreading the risk but also allowing those individual charts to kind of make the decision for me instead of me making some big declaration about where the market I think is going as a whole. And for those of you who visit my site, I would want what I've spent more time on than the trading rules is actually my recommended reading list, because there are a gajillion books out there about trading. There's a handful of them that are just so good in terms of kind of the life lessons these great traders give you. So I would point people to the recommended reading. There's only about 10 of them, but those are like my creme de la creme choices for the greatest trading books out there.
Yeah, once again, the site is The Slope of Hope. I mentioned your books, which we talked about: Panic, Prosperity, and Progress, 5 Centuries of History in the Markets, phenomenal book. Chart Your Way to Profits, The Online Trader's Guide to Technical Analysis with Profit Charts, although profit charts is obviously technical analysis, can be applied with any software that you use. And High Probability Trade Setups, A Chartist's Guide to Real-Time Trading. So, again, a lot of technical analysis, but I strongly encourage, if you don't want to buy the books, which is obviously up to you guys because there's money involved, Slope of Hope is free. You have a lot of – it's amazing. As soon as you post something, it's like you have 30, 40, 50 comments before you can bat an eye. And that speaks to how amazing it is, because it's so hard to build a community, because traders by nature – are very fickle, and it's a very transient space. So
it's a wonderful community. I just want to give a shout out to my slopers out there, because the funny thing about Slope of Hope is that it's a relatively tiny blog. I mean, this is me writing this thing, but there's the most passionate community of traders you can imagine. And you know, some blogs out there might get 10 or 20 comments a week. My blog gets like 1,200 comments a day. It's just constant.
Amazing.
Nonstop. I feel like I started a party 11 years ago, and no one's ever left my house. So it's an amazing place.
Yep. And links to your books and to your site can be found on my site, solutionsology.com. You can get links out to that, plus obviously archive of this show and future shows. You can sign up and find out more about that. But again, Tim, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for writing these books. And thank you for sharing the history of the markets with us and obviously what's going on today. Very important, very prudent for us to know what's going on and how we got to the point we are today and really what to expect. So again, the site slopeofhope.com. And Tim, thank you again for coming on.
Thanks, Ryan. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it so much. Thanks so much.
Take care.